Hello, this is the Trimmed Down podcast version of Tracks of My Life with me, Toby Davey. To catch all my guests' music tracks in full, do listen in to the hour-long version on RNIB Connect Radio every Tuesday at 7 p.m, repeated Thursdays at 1 p.m. and Sundays at 8 p.m. Hello, I'm Toby Davey and you're listening to Tracks of My Life here on RNIB Connect Radio. In Tracks of My Life, we invite a guest to select a few tracks that mean something to them and mark moments in their life, from maybe that first track they ever heard, right through to one track that they would like to pass on that might give hope for the future. My guest this week is radio broadcaster Stephen Scott, who has just hung up his RNIB Connect Radio microphone and headset to concentrate on his other broadcasting work and also to launch his new channel, Blind Guy Talks Tech. Hello, Stephen, and welcome to Tracks of My Life here on RNIB Connect Radio.
Thanks, Toby. Lovely to be here.
So, Stephen, as someone who has spent quite a lot of their life on air in radio and spinning discs, as one might say, how did you find it selecting just seven tracks then?
Oh, an absolute nightmare. I mean, this takes me back to, you know, our wedding when we were trying to find tracks that we could play and actually use as our wedding song. You know, we were just trying to find a wedding song and we really struggled. In fact, by the end, I think we had like four albums worth of content that we could, you know, we were actually considering issuing, you know, like a Now series. We were thinking of having like, you know, Now That's What I Call a Wedding, volumes 1, 2, 3, and 4, just with all the tracks of, you know, of different songs that both my wife and I loved over the years and still do love today. So yeah, picking seven tracks for this was an absolute nightmare, but I think I've picked the right ones.
Well, your first track I think comes from a CD single and it's Circle of Life by Elton John from The Lion King, and a musical that you, I don't think you've actually been to see as yet, but going back to sort of those old CD singles, which I can certainly remember, what was it like hearing this for the first time and going down to the shops and actually buying it?
Well, this is the interesting thing, because at that time, you would get CDs for Christmas, right? I mean, some people still do, actually. But I remember getting this, and, you know, I should be clear on this, that, you know, our family didn't have a lot of money, so, you know, any present was a present, right? So for us, you know, getting something like that was quite a big deal. And, yeah, I remember getting a couple of CDs, and I remember one of them, well, actually, this one in particular was the first one I ever got as a CD single. And yeah, it was Elton John's Circle of Life. And, you know, I was kind of just, I think at that time, I remember having like this GVC boombox type thing. You know, it had the cassette tape player in it, and it had the radio in it, and it had the CD player. And it was really, a really solid thing. I remember it was brilliant, and the sound off it was incredible. And putting the CD in and listening to it. And I'll be honest, you know, the song, it was okay. I mean, I like the song, I do, and it always takes me back to that moment, which is ultimately the point, right? But, you know, the song itself over the years kind of drifted away. But, you know, it was a really interesting, you know, experience just to hear that for the first time through that device, through that means. And then, of course, you know, start buying CDs endlessly after that. But no, like you say, I mean, despite getting the Circle of Life, Elton John's song from The Lion King, I've never seen the film, and I've never seen the musical, and I don't understand why my mother bought that one for me. I have no idea. I must have just expressed an interest at the time when it was on the radio, and she's thought, oh, I'll get him that one.
And what sort of memories of your sort of home life come back to you when you hear this track?
Well, I remember, you know, I grew up in a tenement in Glasgow, and, you know, it wasn't the easiest of lives. For me as a kid, it was great. I mean, I knew nothing other than just absolute joy and running around and having a great time. You know, being visually impaired, I think like a lot of people who were visually impaired, either growing up in Glasgow or frankly anywhere in the world, your mum and dad might mollycoddle you a little bit. You know, they might cotton wool you. And for that reason, I wasn't really allowed out very often into the streets. I mean, I wouldn't go quite so far to say the mean streets of Glasgow, but they certainly weren't, you know, paved with gold either. So it was a case of maybe best keeping away from that. And, you know, it meant I spent a lot of time in my room. I spent a lot of time with my family. We played a lot of games, you know, and a lot of people talk about growing up in those tenements as horrible experiences. But, you know, I always think back to Billy Connolly talking about it and saying, you know, it wasn't horrible. It was great. It was brilliant. And as a kid, you know, it was like a labyrinth, you know, of places you could explore and have fun, you know, without even leaving the front door. All the people you could talk to and all the the friends you could make just in one close, in one tenement. So, you know, I think back to those days and I think back to enjoying music with my family. Music was a big part of my family growing up. My mother used to sing a lot at home. She would love to play her guitar. My dad loved his music. He was more into the kind of hi-fi and the components, so that really suited me. You know, it was great. And that this song is one of actually a few today that I've picked that really take me back to that place.
It's the joy and the stampede. You should never take more than you give in the circle of life.
The Circle of Life there by Elton John, and your first CD single, Stephen, too.
Yeah.
Now we come to a track that I think it comes from one of those compilation CD albums, and I think it's track 9 from Hit 6.
This is not a particularly spectacular, you know, hits style here. You know, this is it's the thing about my career in music, or my life in music in some ways, is it didn't, you know, come from some deep-rooted place. A lot of it was experiences. You know, that's what I've tended to notice. It's always experiences that happened that kind of popped up. And when you asked me to do this, it kind of, all that came flooding back. You know, all these points in my life where things would happen. And you would just think, that moment always stuck in my mind. And this is just yet another one.
Oh, and I think the album came out in the sort of late 80s. What were you up to at that time? Were you at school or were you sort of, you know, maybe striding out in life?
Oh, no. I'm just turning 40 in at the tail end of 21. And at that point in my life, I was just a kid. I was a primary school kid. I was, you know, spending a lot of time, you know, like I said, you know, not really going out into the streets and playing like most kids might do, but actually spending a lot of time with family, which I loved. And I would go to visit my grandmother. I would go and visit my own grandmother every day, but my dad's side, you know, go and visit his mum, Janet, and we'd go and we'd spend time at her house. And he, at that point, they had a hi-fi unit there as well. And I had never experienced at that stage in my life, I'd never experienced CD, I'd never experienced, you know, listening to it via headphones. It was always, you know, AM radio, or it was cassette tapes. And that was kind of it. You know, FM, you know, occasionally, but my mum grew up listening to a local radio station in Scotland, still going, actually, Clyde too. And, it, you know, that was the station, that was a soundtrack to my life, and it kind of got me into, I think, the best music, because they played such a range of music from way back up to today. And I like that because I got the chance to experience all these different artists. You know, if you listen to the modern pop stations, as a lot of the kids in my school did, you only got like a real snapshot of what today's music was. You never really got the sense of what had gone before. So I loved that. I loved listening to AM radio for that. Now, of course, I didn't think that at the time because I'm a kid, right? What do I know about anything? I'm still working out what these 10 fingers are for. So, you know, I don't know anything. But at the same token, it was clear in my mind that I was loving this music. I was loving hearing it. But then I visit my gran Janet one day. We're up there and we're all having a bit of an evening. And my dad says to me, come over here and sit down. And I sit down in front of this hi-fi unit. And he says, and he hands me a pair of headphones. And he says, put these in your head. And I'm then subjected to the Hits Album 6, which was the album that was in the CD player at the time. And on this was the track Nothing's Going to Stop Us Now by Starship. And I had never heard CD before, never heard that quality, that range of sound before. And I was just blown away. And I must have wore that CD out. I still got that CD. And I keep it to this day for that reason, because I just love the memories it brings back of that time. Just sitting there, you know, staring at this CD player. It was a Sony CD player. It was like a black unit, you know, one of those separates. And then you had the silver amp and the record player above and all that. And this kind of it was like a walnut, I guess, framed unit. Just incredible, you know, the memories it brings back, the smell of the CDs, the smell of the records as well, which I remember coming back. All that comes back to me when I think of that time. But the sound and the quality really shone through. And yeah, that was me hooked on CDs.
We
So Starship and Nothing's Gonna Stop Us Now, and a track from an album that you were blown away by with the sound quality as a child, Stephen. Stephen, we are now going to go back to high school life for you. And I wondered, what was sort of high school life like for you? Was it a school especially for visually impaired young people? And what was it all like? What were those days like?
Well, I had a mum who was absolutely determined that despite, you know, maybe not having the opportunities to wander the streets of Glasgow until 11 o'clock at night, oh, what a shame, she decided that I should, however, be in as mainstream an environment as possible when it comes to education. So she was very keen to make sure that I went into mainstream education from day one. Now, at that time, and we're talking 1984, 85, around about that time, where I was going into primary school, it was not seen as appropriate to put a visually impaired child into mainstream education. And she had to fight to get me into that school. And it was seen at the time by the local Glasgow council school board or whoever they were, you know, they were basically saying, look, this is an experiment, but if it doesn't work, he's off to specialist school. Simple as that. They were not keen on this at all, and they could not understand how this would work. And, you know, when I think back to primary school initially, I think back to the days when my mum had to come in. I mean, imagine this today. She had to come into the school, and she would have to direct the teacher on the best place to put me in the class so that I would be out of the way of glare, that I'd be able to see the blackboard. She would even have to draw the black lines in the jotters, because the school would not do that. And they couldn't provide anything like that. So they didn't understand. So you would have the jotters with all the lines on it. She would have to draw a line, say every two lines. She'd have to draw a dark line. You imagine that, right? You have to... She's working all day. She has to come home. And then she's got to sit and draw all these lines and all these these jotters so that I can essentially get an education. And she did things like that. And I mean, that was just one example of all the things that she did. But she was determined to make sure I could do that. And when it came to secondary education, she wanted the same. And at that time, things were improving a little bit. Things were getting better. And there was a school in the south side of Glasgow. I was in the east end of Glasgow, so a bit of a distance, that had a visual impairment unit, as it was called. I don't know if you'd call that. I don't know what you'd call it these days, but you probably wouldn't call it that. And the visual impairment unit would house us visually impaired folk in amongst a mainstream setting. So we'd go to mainstream class, but we would have a resource area that we could go to for support, for extra help with classes, or perhaps for, you know, making sure our materials are accessible. And, you know, comparing to today, and I don't know obviously what kids' life is like these days, I hope it's better than what I experienced, you know, because despite the fact that the education was great, and I'd actually gone all right, you know, to summarise it essentially, you know, large print meant that they would photocopy something from A4 to A3. So you get, you know, a page of text that was just essentially enlarged in a photocopier, and that was the best they would do or could do. And, you know, they would, you would actually end up finding that the visual impairment unit became a refuge for all the things you didn't really want to face as a kid, or didn't feel you had to face, or the teachers felt you shouldn't have to face. So, for example, physical education. The class would happen, I would go along, and every single time, Toby, every time, the teacher would say, right, Stephen, off to the unit. And that was it. I was sent back to the VI unit, because it was a case of, don't even bother with this. It's not, you know, we're going to play football today, or we're going to do running, or we're going to do something, and you'll likely fall and die. So don't do that. Just go away and do something else. Now, you can see that as a negative, and many would, but the upside was I got to play with computers all day. And that's where my love of computers came in, because I spent most of my time, you know, working these things out and actually helping the visual impairment unit get up and running with computers. You know, I had to plug them all up and get them all set up and running and do all that kind of stuff. So I became a bit of a technical guy at that point. And that was in some ways thanks to that environment. Now, you can see it as a negative, but I tend to try and look for positives and things in life. And I think that ended up a positive.
You've chosen a classic Alanis Morissette track from her iconic Jagged Little Pill album. And I wondered which track have you chosen from this album, and can you remember singing along to it? Because I think you may have sung along to it back then.
Oh, I did. I did. I picked You Learn as the one to play. I mean, to be honest, the whole album was brilliant, and it really was an iconic album. We didn't know that at the time. We just loved listening to it, and I'd go around my friend's house again, around the hi-fi, although it was a bit of a modern, more modern hi-fi, one of those plasticky ones. Still had the LP, you know, record player in it, and double tape deck, and... you know, all that, but it was all encased in one unit with, you know, a speaker either side. And yeah, I used to sit there with my friend and we would just listen to this album. And I don't know why it stuck in our heads and why we listened to it so much, but we did. And You Learn was the track that we just sang along to a lot.
Wait until the dust sets.
You Learn there by Alanis Morissette, and a track that takes you back to high school days, Stephen.
Did you hear me singing, Toby? Did you hear me singing?
I think we'll keep that. Keep the singing out. I think if we can. Oh, dear. Well, your next track, Stephen, actually takes you back to your first days on commercial radio, and it's Two Hearts by Phil Collins. But I wondered, how did you get into commercial radio, and... did your sight come into the question at all when you went for your interview?
Well, it was really interesting. I got the opportunity to go on work experience during a course I was on. I was on a year-long radio broadcasting course, one of the first at the time. And I'd got 6 months in, and I got a bit fed up with the course, to be honest, Toby, because I thought, these people aren't teaching me anything. I just didn't feel that I was learning anything. I wanted to be in a radio station. And I thought, I just want to be around people who are doing this every day, who know what they're doing, or at least pretend to, as I learned later. But the reality was, you know, that the work experience opportunity came along and I got the chance to go in. And I basically said to myself, I've got 2 weeks work experience and I'm not leaving here without a job. I will do whatever it takes to get this gig. And, you know, it literally involved everything. I mean, it involved, you know, moving furniture and rearranging settees in the reception room and, you know, spending oodles of time on a computer entering, you know, mind-numbing data in. I didn't care. I just wanted to be on air. And the one asset that I've always had in my life, which I'm grateful and thankful for, and going back to, you know, my earlier point about my mum not letting me out the front door, being from the East End of Glasgow, you know, I didn't develop the accent that tends to come along with that, right? I didn't develop an East End of Glasgow accent. And that's not to say it's a bad thing. It's not at all. But at the end of the day, to work in radio, you need to be able to speak to as many people as possible. And you need to be clear and concise. And I was lucky that I had a voice that could achieve that. And I've had many compliments over the years on my voice. I don't really take any of them particularly seriously, but I appreciate the compliment. But at the end of the day, you know, I can't really be proud of something I've got no control over. It's just my voice. It wasn't a trained voice. It just became this. And it served me well. And that was the thing that immediately caught the attention of the bosses. They said, wow, we'd love to hear your voice on air. And I was thinking, oh, I've got a hook. They're interested. And I got the chance to go on air. They gave me the end of the second week. The Friday coming up, they asked me if I would want to have a show on air between 12 midnight and 3 a.m. into Saturday morning to try me out. And you know that way that before they'd even finished the sentence, I'm like, yes, 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 please. And the site thing never came up, right? And it's interesting you say that because I never really thought about that. But no, it never came up. They never asked. They did ask me about my visual impairment. But interestingly, they did have another member of staff there who was blind. And it never was a thing. It was never a discussion about that. There was never a discussion about the capability. And again, it probably feeds into the fact that once someone is working there who is visually impaired, there's immediately an expectation that, well, if they're capable of doing it, you are. You know, so in a sense, it kind of paved the way for me to be able to come in and not have to face all that. That already had been dealt with. And I remember, and I can say this now, because the career's moved on a bit. But at the time, I knew nothing about the tech in regards to the radio station side, you know, the playout systems and all the computerized elements of it. I was a CD guy. When I was at hospital radio, it was always CDs and cart machines. It was all very physical and tactile. It was great. But in these new radio studios, it was all computer-driven, and I had never used any of these things. But I was good at bluffing, and I was asked the question, you know, do you know how this system works? And I'm like, yeah, of course, no problem. Yeah, I'm great with computers. And because I'd been doing stuff on the computer during the week, they kind of knew I was adept at least using a computer. But that was like it. You know, like I could turn it on and use it and do basic stuff, you know, in terms of the admin side, but not never on air. So when it came to the day that I had to do this, I was so lucky because the guy who was on air before me was the blind guy. And he finished at midnight. And I had gone in, and I'd gone into the studio. I mean, I was in the station pretty much the whole day. I couldn't tear myself away from the place. And I'd gone in there about, say, 10 o'clock or something at night. And I said to him, would it be possible to, you know, spend some time with you to learn how this all works? And he said, yeah, no problem. He says, okay, so he said, look, I could show you all this different, you know, I could show you all this and I could get into it in real detail. He said, but here's the thing. There's a button here that turns the mic on. And I've got a button here. And this green button here, he said, when you finish talking, press that green button. And that, Toby, was my training on how this whole thing worked before I'd gone on air. And that was it. That's all I knew. That is all I knew. And the rest I picked up myself. And I'd gone on air at midnight. I had the most fun I ever had with my clothes on. And it was just brilliant. I don't remember much of it. I remember being very sweaty at the end of it because I was absolutely terrified. And I got a call just after 3 a.m. from the boss. She called me. I was amazed, actually. She was even awake at that point, but she called. And she said, you're not going back to college. Come see me Monday.
Wow.
And that was it. Career started there. And I was just, and I was so excited. You cannot imagine. Always there behind you. Just to remind you of two hearts living in just one mind. You know we're two hearts living in just one mind.
Phil Collins there and Two Hearts, and the first track that you played on radio, Stephen. Your next track has a bit of a country feel to me, I think, anyway. And I think it's one which was a favourite of your mum's and was on the radio and on cassette tapes as well back then. Would you mind telling me a bit about your early life growing up with your mum as a single parent family, if that's all right?
Yeah. I mean, it's a... This is the bit you try and get the tears. Is this like the Piers Morgan bit where he always tries to get them to cry?
I'll try not to do that.
Well, the thing is, you know, my mum looked after me growing up because my dad, my real dad, if you like, he disappeared at a young age. My stepdad took over when he came on the scene about 6 years old, and you know, he is my real dad as far as I'm concerned, and he always will be. But yeah, I remember just growing up, and we didn't have anything. I mean, we had literally nothing. I mean, nothing. I think we're lucky to have a bed. In fact, we had to share a bed for a number of years because we didn't even have a separate room in that particular tenement flat we were in. Some nights we didn't have electric. Some nights we didn't have anything, you know. So some nights it was just really just us, you know, spending time together, my mum reading stories, you know, spending time with my grandmother. I mean, my gran and my mum brought me up, essentially. And, you know, I don't know if this is appropriate to say or not these days. You never know what you're allowed to get away with. But, you know, honestly, I grew up with two very strong Glasgow women. And they taught me that, A, you don't muck around with women because, you know, they know more than men ever will. Fact number one. And it taught me how to talk. It's honestly the truth. Because that's all we did in our family. It was just talk and talk and talk. And music was on. If we weren't singing with the music, we were talking about the music or we were talking around the music. So, you know, it was a really joyous experience, a real passion-filled family, a love-filled family. And, you know, you don't have to have anything. I mean, you know, I'm a very lucky person. I've got a great life and a lovely house and a beautiful wife and, you know, great dogs and, you know, all the wonderful things, you know, and I've got money that I can buy nice things and all that. But, you know, I'm always looking back to those days and thinking, you know, I wasn't any less happy then, and I had nothing, and neither did my mother. So, you know, at that time, having nothing, you might think that would be negative, and certainly I'm sure for my mum it wasn't the best time of her life, but I still look back on that time with a sense of fondness because it taught me the importance of family, it taught me the importance of people around me. And that's something that I think I'll always live with. But the music certainly brings me back to that. And you know, although I wasn't necessarily a country music fan, I was surrounded by a lot of it. My mum and grandma had listened to a lot of this kind of stuff. And this artist, I know she was a huge fan of, Anne Murray, who weirdly, I was in my wife and I went to New York in 2007, and we'd gone into the Virgin Megastore in Times Square, and Anne Murray was playing when I walked in. I thought, that's weird, isn't it? I mean, of all the tracks you would think would play in a Virgin Megastore in 2007 in New York, Anne Murray's not the artist I would have thought would be playing. But, yeah, it was great to hear. And this song, yeah, it just takes me back to some of those nights when, you know, it was just my mum and I, and we were in our house, in our flat, and just sitting there listening to music on the record player.
Could I have this dance for the rest of my life? Would you be my partner? Every night when we're together, it feels so right. Could I have this dance?
Could I have this dance there by Anne Murray, and one for your mum, I think, Stephen, too.
Yeah, definitely.
Now we come to a track that is a real country track, and a special R&B Connect exclusive recording from the Shires. And I wondered, is there a link between those early days and listening to tracks like Anne Murray and the Shires that has sort of sowed a seed in your head about country music at all?
Yeah, I think that's absolutely what happened. I mean, you know, I grew up in such a rich diet of music. It was really filled with so many different artists and genres. And although I would never really pick a particular genre or artist, I just couldn't pick one that I would say is my favourite, because, you know, I can go from one end of the scale to the other depending on my mood. And I think anybody who's into music in any way is the same. You can't, it's very hard to pick a particular track or artist. But country does, it tells a story. And it does it in such a way that I think is just so imaginative and more creative, you know, because even in a verse or even in a chorus, you tend to find choruses are the same in every track. Whereas in country, the chorus develops along with the story. So it doesn't, it's never as simple as that the verse tells the story and the chorus reminds you of the idea or tells you of the, you know, the kind of overview of it or whatever. It's actually developing with it and changes with it, which makes the songs more engaging. And there's some great writers. I mean, country music has evolved over the years. I mean, it's gone from, you know, banjo music, you know, folk music, you know, blues, all that kind of mix of music and styles into what became country bluegrass, I should say, more than blues, although arguably, but, you know, to modern, more rocky country, more pop based. It's really developed over the years, and I think that's the one thing. People talk about country music as a bit of a church. It's a bit of a church of music where there's a lot of different styles in there. And, you know, I fell in love with it actually properly maybe in the about late 90s, early 2000s. A friend of mine who's sadly no longer with us, he got me really into a lot of the kind of Garth Brooks, Trisha Yearwood, Clint Black, Brad Paisley, Keith Urban, you know, all those artists who are, you know, some of them, you know, still very much in the charts today, some of them less so. But, you know, that music just started to resonate with me because of those stories. And I could have picked 1,000 songs from the country world to play. I picked this one, though, because I got the chance to meet these guys before they were big and famous. And I remember making the joke saying, will you still talk to me once you're big and famous? Because you will be. And they said yes. And I held them to that later in life. And they did. They still talked to me, which was lovely. But yeah, I got the chance to sit with them in this pokey little room in Edinburgh, and I sat with them, and I had taken along my microphone, which was just like they call it a flash mic. It's basically just a microphone with an SD card built in. It's a mono mic, not the greatest thing in the world to record with, but I was intending just to do an interview. And then they said, would you like us to sing something for you? And I'm like, okay. So I'm sitting there. You got to imagine the scene, right? They're maybe expecting a proper studio recording. I'm sitting with a mic held out in front of them as they're bellowing out this hit. And I think it picked up pretty well, to be honest. I think I could, if I'd thought it through more, I'd have taken better equipment with me. But this was, you know, a track which went on to become very popular. It's a gorgeous track. And I was so pleased to be one of the first few to hear it in the world, frankly, because, you know, they weren't performing that widely. It wasn't getting played on radio at that time. So I got the chance to hear it and record it for posterity with Ben and Chrissy from the band.
It's not the first time I've seen you cry. You don't have to be so brave tonight.
A magical version of Brave there by the Shires. Stephen, we now come to your final track, the one that you might like to pass on that maybe might give people hope for the future or just lift their spirits. What is the track and why have you chosen it?
So the track I chose, and I think this does deliver some hope in a world that is terrifying, and it alludes to that in the track and in the words of the song. It's by an artist called Luke Bryan, who I only recently, I mean, I know of Luke Bryan of years but gone by, but this was kind of the first couple of times I'd get into him recently. This track really resonated with me. The song's called Most People Are Good, and I just think it sums up my view of the world, which is that most people are good. You know, people who try and help me on a daily basis if I'm out and about and I'm maybe standing at a road and someone says, do you want help crossing the road? I just think that says a lot about a character of a person, that they're willing to help someone else. And yes, sometimes I admit I don't always want to cross that road and I've been taken across it anyway. But, you know, we find our way. But at the end of the day, I think it's about, you know, being positive and being decent to other people. That's my take on the way. And, you know, I think if we all took a bit more personal responsibility in our lives and we all considered each other a bit more, I think we might have a happier world overall. And I think this song says that.
Well, thank you so much, Stephen Scott, for sharing your tracks of my life with me here on RNIB Connect Radio.
It's been an absolute pleasure, Toby. Thanks for letting me on.
I believe most people are good and most mamas ought to qualify for sainthood. I believe most Friday nights look better under neon or stadium lights. I believe you love who you love. Ain't nothing you should ever be ashamed of.